Welcome to State of the Bay. I'm Grace Wan. Every Monday night, we're live and local with news, conversation, and culture from this place we call home. Coming up in the next hour, we'll get the latest on the instantly beloved, overachieving Golden State Valkyries. They are the feel-good story of the summer, selling out Chase Center and winning a surprising number of games in this, their inaugural season. Could they actually make the playoffs? And we'll explore the ways in which federal dysfunction could spur a regional approach to challenging issues around housing, transportation, the environment, and homelessness. Plus, we'll hear about a new San Francisco walking tour that covers the improbable life of William Leidesdorf, America's first Black millionaire. Welcome to State of the Bay. I'm Grace Wan. Later on in the hour, we'll explore the ways the federal government's dysfunction could spur more of a regional approach to the Bay Area's challenges. Then we'll learn about a new walking tour in San Francisco that follows the storied life of William Leidesdorf. But first, this is the inaugural season of the Golden State Valkyries. That's the new WNBA franchise that plays in Chase Center and is, like the Warriors, owned by Joe Lacob. If you haven't heard of them or been to a game, they were a bit of sensation this summer, and Bay Area fans are crazy for the team, which maybe will make the playoffs. Here with me tonight to talk about the Valkyries' surprising season is Maya Goldberg-Safer. Maya is a contributing reporter for Bounce, KLW's podcast on the Valkyries' first season, which is not to be missed, by the way. And she also has a Substack on the NBA called Rough Notes. Welcome to State of the Bay, Maya.
Hi, thank you for having me. Really excited to be here.
I mean, who doesn't want to talk about the Valkyries? They are having, it's like a fairy tale. So what do you make of the Bay Area's embrace of this new inaugural WNBA team?
Yeah, I mean, it's really amazing. And I was born and raised in Oakland playing basketball since I was pretty young. And I just think that audiences here in the Bay have been so ready for this, you know, for decades. It goes all the way back to the San Francisco Pioneers, the first pro women's basketball team that played here in the Bay Area from 1979 to 1981. You know, you have fans that are showing up to Valkyries games that were there back then. And then, of course, we have the now defunct Sacramento Monarchs. Joe Lacob was a major investor in an ABL team that was around for just a few years, around 1996, the San Jose Lasers, Cal and Stanford women's basketball. I just think that audiences have been super hungry for this, more than ready for it. And so they're really just showing up in droves and so excited.
Yeah, the hungry for women's basketball in particular.
Yes.
I mean, with the Caitlin Clark situation. I mean, you know, the phenom that she is that you think what people are like attracted to or?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. You know, actually, I was at the Indiana Fever game against the Valkyries earlier in the season when she came to town for the first time. And, you know, I think that Caitlin Clark is a generational talent. I think that she and her sort of peers, you know, Angel Reese as well, Cameron Brink have brought a lot of energy to the WNBA. But I also think that, you know, the fans here are really excited about not just sort of like one star in particular, but just having the WNBA here. And the WNBA over the years, you know, before Caitlin Clark as well, has really been changing dramatically. So it was initially this league when it launched, you know, in the late 90s, the league was really all about marketing its players as being sort of feminine, as being, you know, all around women who can also play basketball, but then sort of put their heels back on. And over the years, the WNBA has really become this league where players are more and more able to be outspoken about their identities, about political activism, about their queerness. And I think that that has made a huge impact as well on what makes this so appealing for progressive Bay Area audiences.
Well, you mentioned the queerness and the of, you know, the celebration of progressive values. And certainly among the Bay Area's lesbian community, this is a popular team.
Yes. Definitely. This is for sure. I think that, you know, so often the sort of mainstream sports fandom around professional sports can be pretty like macho and masculinist and not necessarily inviting to queer folks. And that is not true in women's basketball. Women's basketball has long been really a sport. They used to call it a glass closet for lesbians. For a long time, the WNBA didn't really recognize that. But at this point, I think it's a place where you can go, especially lesbians, and feel proud of who you are and be around people that look like you or who support you. And I think that that's really refreshing for fans. You know, that is not always true of sports fandom. But here in the Bay, where we have such a strong queer community, I think we're really showing out for a team and for a culture that is all about queerness.
Well, let's talk about the actual team. I mean, yep. The expectations for an inaugural team in the WNBA are generally low, right? It's your first year. You're trying to figure out who you are, how you play. Tell us a little bit about what's the style of play of this team. Like, if I'm going for the first time, what am I going to find?
Yes. Okay. So the Valkyries always have sort of a different rotation or group of people playing or starting games. And this is based on a couple of factors. There have been a large number of injuries this season, but they're also in some changeover on the roster. But also the offense was really designed by head coach Natalie Nicasi to be a sort of plug and play and to be able to move in all of the different players, to play aggressively, to move the ball, and also to play in this really scrappy way. So this is a team that is made up of a bunch of players, many of whom were unprotected by their former WNBA teams. So there was an expansion draft coming into this season where, you know, this is the first expansion team in the WNBA in a number of years. And so these other teams had to choose which of their players they were going to protect and who they were going to leave unprotected at risk of being drafted by the Valkyries. And so many of these players were left unprotected and are coming in and sort of have a little bit of a chip on their shoulder, know that they were a little bit expendable to their former teams, that maybe they played a specific role. And now they're emerging and they're really showing that, like, they hadn't met their ceiling yet in terms of what they're capable of. So you have, for example, Veronica Burton, who is a guard on the Valkyries, who was not known for scoring and now has proved herself to be an incredible offensive threat on the floor and is in the running for most improved player of the year in the WNBA. So we're really getting to see this team of women that are sort of showing what they're capable of beyond expectations.
It kind of reminds me of the Warriors maybe 12 years ago before they were as good as they are today. And you kind of knew who the players were. Steph Curry wasn't quite Steph Curry. Klay Thompson wasn't Klay Thompson. They were a small ball team. You know, they weren't big and they were really scrappy. I mean, is that something that is kind of the ethos of the Golden State Warriors or the Golden State's approach to building teams?
Well, I think, you know, just to shout out the Warriors, right? The Valkyries are playing at Chase Center, like you mentioned, the home of the Warriors. And I think that it's really a place that it is sort of at this point, like Steph Curry's house, more or less. And so the Valkyries have, like, I think the highest percentage of free throws attempted per, or not free throws, sorry, 3-point shots attempted per game. So we are still sort of shooting the lights out. Well, we're not, we have sort of a middling percentage in terms
so
of
great.
How many.
Yes. Yeah.
Yes. But when, you know, the crowd is ready for it. So there are a lot of threes that are being shot. Definitely. They're oftentimes playing a 5-out offense. And I think that, yeah, it also feels perhaps in a way that, that the Warriors felt at a time like we're sort of on the cutting edge of the WNBA and what it's capable of. And having this model of a team where it's everyone all in, playing together scrappily, there's not necessarily one star player. It's a bit of a newer sort of format. And I think that alongside the total excitement and sort of buy-in of the audience is really showing the WNBA as a whole, like what these expansion teams are capable of.
Well, you know, across the WNBA, I mean, here are the Valkyries, and they play at Chase Center, which they have called Ballhalla, which is incredible marketing. And they're having a really lovely experience in that way. But across the WNBA, not all the teams get to play in the, you know, a fancy NBA stadium, right?
Right, exactly. This is very true. So this is, you know, if you compare, for example, the experience of being at a Valkyries game and being at a Chicago Sky game, I have been living back and forth between Chicago and the Bay Area for a long time. And that arena in Chicago is built for DePaul University. So it's a college arena, and you can really feel sort of a marked difference. It feels much more amateur. And here, you know, I think that there are a lot of things that come with the fact that, you know, the Warriors franchise or the Golden State franchise has made so much money, has been infused with sort of the tech money of the Bay Area in the last 10 to 15 years. But it really does get you a heightened experience. It also gets you higher ticket prices. Mm-hmm. And that's sort of part of, I think, the experience right now and like where we're at in 2025 in the Bay Area with professional sports.
Well, you know, at one of the recent games, the WNBA players had T-shirts that say, pay us what you owe us. Mm-hmm. And, you know, so they're getting, the Valkyries are getting to play at Chase Center. They're owned by the Golden State franchise. Is that money, I mean, these games are sold out. They're selling out Chase. Is that money trickling down to the players? Or is there still, I mean, I'm sure there's a vast differential between what a WNBA player gets makes and what even just a journeyman Warriors player makes.
Yes, definitely. So the salary cap in the WNBA is still something like, the maximum salary cap is something like $230,000. And there are baked into the WNBA contracts, there are these like league-wide standards. You can't deviate from just because your team is owned by Joe Lacob, for example. Mm-hmm. And so right now the WNBA players are fighting for a new contract, a new collective bargaining agreement that needs to be reached by October 31st of this year before next season. And that is a huge fight that they are involved in. And they believe that they are not getting the proper revenue share from all of the money that is coming in to the WNBA through the broadcast deals that have been made, through recent, you know, transactions, including these expansion franchises that Golden State kind of started it out. But now we're getting Portland, Toronto, Cleveland, Philadelphia, Detroit in the coming years. And teams are being purchased, franchises are being purchased for $250 million. So there's really a lack of transparency from the league and from the NBA, which, you know, controls the WNBA, the majority of, you know, at this point, in order to understand how the money really works. And so the players definitely believe that they are owed more.
You know, our producer, Wendy Holcomb, says at Chase Center, it's a $23 fried chicken sandwich at a Valkyries game. I mean, it's like I certainly hope the players are getting some portion of that. With the time we have left, Matt, let's talk about our playoff chances.
Okay.
Are we in the running to get into the playoffs?
Yeah, we are in the thick of it. Ooh. Right now. It is no joke. The Valkyries are 19-18. They're right there in this playoff run. In particular, I would say with the Los Angeles Sparks. So if you're looking for some NorCal SoCal mm-hmm. rivalry, it's for sure happening. And a few other teams, Indiana, Washington Mystics, Seattle Storm. And so we're really, I think, we're taking it game by game. Mm-hmm. There's no sort of definitive, if they lose this one game, then they're out of it, right? It really depends on this sort of tapestry of games that are going on that all of these different teams are having. We have a tough schedule, but these other teams are also facing tough schedules to round out the season. And every game really, really, really matters. So if you do have a chance to go to a game before the end of the season and you haven't been yet, for sure the time is now.
When will we know if we make the playoffs?
Okay, that's a great question. I don't think any of us know. I don't think that the Valkyries wish that they knew. Again, it is just sort of this like exhausting puzzle right now in terms of all the different teams competing. And so we're not sure. I think it will come down to the wire, really. I think the final game is maybe September 11th.
Yeah. Well, we're certainly rooting for that. And thank you so much for being with us. That's Maya Goldberg-Safer. She's got a Substack about the WNBA called Rough Notes. And you can listen to her extremely awesome podcast called The Bounce, which is about the Valkyries' first season. You can find those links on the State of the Bay page at KALW.org. Thanks so much for being here, Maya.
Thank you so much for having me. Go Valks.
Yep.
Peace up.
Yep. All right. Coming up next on State of the Bay, we'll talk about why regional cooperation may be more important than ever for the Bay Area. That's right after the break. Stay with us.
Tune in Wednesdays during Morning Edition and All Things Considered for a KALW exclusive, Natural State. Host Marissa Ortega-Welch will take you all over California, a tour of the landscapes and life forms that make this state unique and special. It's an exploration and an escape showcasing the natural world. Join us every Wednesday at 7:15 and 3:45. Natural State, only on KALW.
Hi, this is Janae Darden, host of KALW's Sights and Sounds. I just want to thank you for standing with KALW. Thank you for listening to our shows that provide you information on music, art, and culture in the Bay Area. Whether you recently donated to KALW or have a monthly membership, I deeply appreciate you. We can't do what we do without you. It's up to us to make the media we all deserve and need together. Thank you.
Welcome back to State of the Bay. I'm Grace Wan. Tonight, I'm talking to two people who spend their professional lives thinking about how to make the Bay Area better. This means they're looking at both the challenges and the opportunities. We're going to take a break from talking about challenges and maybe a little focus on opportunities today. How do people who are looking at data, trends, and policies for a living think about our region right now? And how can we all collaborate to make it even better? Is this an antidote to federal dysfunction? That is regional cooperation. We're going to open the phone lines now, and our producer's checking our email. So we really want to hear from you about how you're feeling about living in the Bay Area. Tell us what you think could be made better and how you think we can become less siloed as a region and work more cooperatively across counties. We're at 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-8255. You can find us on social media or email us at stateofthebay@kalw.org. First up, we've got tonight here Russell Hancock. He's the president and CEO of Joint Venture Silicon Valley. That's a think tank supported by major sectors such as business, government, labor, and academia. Welcome to State of the Bay, Russell.
Happy to be here. Thank you.
And we also have Sujata Srivastava. She's the Chief Policy Officer at SPUR, or the San Francisco Bay Area Planning and Urban Research Association. SPUR is a little bit easier to say. That's a nonprofit public policy organization that released its 50-year regional plan a couple years ago. Welcome back to State of the Bay, Sujata.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah. Russell, let's start with you. You recently wrote an op-ed in the San Jose Mercury News that was kind of a call to action. In a way, you were seeking more regional cooperation and saying that we've got some opportunities right now. Tell me what regional cooperation looks like.
I have this notion we should take a long-term view of our future and plan for it. We can think about 50 years in the future. That's not too long of a horizon. We should be thinking about not only our children and our grandchildren. What I suggested in the op-ed is that it's time to put together a commission. Maybe you could call it a task force. I think it would have big city mayors leading it. I think you should have county supervisors also participating. But importantly, you would also have CEOs. Participating along with labor leaders, heads of the major foundations. We need the college and university presidents there. And the major medical campuses should also be represented. These August people should meet on a regular basis, and I mean quarterly, every other month. And this is an effort that should be staffed. There should be the region's best people, experts, domain experts in these various facets of our living here that you identified. It would be staffed. There would be reports. There would be discovery. There would be a process of recommendations. This is a process that would take a couple of years. You don't rush this kind of thing, but it would be thorough. It would be painstaking, and it would be a conscientious approach to thinking about our future. But here's the key. We would think big. When you're brainstorming, every idea should be thrown out on the table, and then we test them. We study them. We analyze the data. We analyze our patterns, but we also envision the future and how those patterns are likely to change with the technologies that are just right out there in front of us.
Well, what would you like this, you know, dream team of thinkers to be working on?
Well, our challenges are multifaceted. They include everything from transportation and mobility to our housing woes, but they also include our sustainability issues, the pressing need that we have to address our resiliency against water shortages, chronic water shortages, fires, other kinds of natural disasters. And then we happen to have the nation's highest income and wealth gaps, and so we have really got to be doing something about an economy that's creating opportunity for some, but not for all.
So, John, I wanted to turn to you. I mean, SPUR has a 50-year regional plan. It released it in 2020, and obviously a lot has happened since then, including the fact that SPUR's former CEO, Alicia John Baptiste, has gone into work with Daniel Lurie directly to kind of, I think, hopefully implement some of these ideas. So when we think about this 50-year regional plan, I mean, give me some highlights. Like, what it was it that SPUR thought could be done?
Yeah, we wanted to sort of imagine what the Bay Area could look like in 2070 if we get it right. So really imagining a place where we do have housing for everyone, where we're able to grow sustainably within our existing urban footprints instead of sprawling out and into our hazard areas and in our green spaces, where we could deal with racial and social inequalities, and we could also protect ourselves from climate change. So, you know, that was sort of the big vision. And for each of these, we can kind of, we proposed some of the solutions that we could take on to address these questions. So how do we build housing in the right places? How do we make sure that our transportation network is responsive to the travel needs that exist today and into the future? How do we make sure that we have an inclusive region where we have opportunities for everybody? And what are the kinds of actions we need to take, you know, similar to what Gress just said, what do we need to do to be able to have the right governance to be able to tackle all of these challenges? Because housing, climate change, economic inequality, infrastructure, all of these are regional in nature. And if we want to meet the moment and we want to have a future, we need the regional governance systems that are designed to respond at that scale and the right tools to get there, and new ways of collaborating across different governments.
It's so interesting. I mean, when I think about the problems that you've just described, Sujata, like climate change, I don't always think about that as a regional problem. I mean, it feels global and so beyond what we here in the Bay, our nine counties of the Bay Area can handle. So, like, taking that as an example, how does that, how do you address that from a regional or more local perspective?
Yeah, I think the one really good example of this is really thinking about sea level rise, right? So we share the Bay Shore, and a lot of communities are already experiencing coastal flooding. And without coordination across different jurisdictions, it's really hard for you to build levees, flood walls, and other projects, because protecting one community could actually increase flood risk for a neighboring community. So you really have to look at this in a coordinated way. The other advantage of doing this in a regional way is that you can actually leverage a lot more resources. So, you know, one example of this is in San Mateo County, they formed a special purpose district called One Shoreline. And they have all 20 cities and the county participating in this district. And it can actually manage funding for resilience projects. It can do a countywide early flood warning system. It can enact, it can actually collect property taxes and, you know, use those resources to be able to do the planning and coordination. So they're really taking an important leadership role in making sure that all of the communities that are affected by sea level rise in San Mateo County are working together and collaborating and planning for their future.
Well, that's, I mean, that seems like a perfect example. I mean, Russ, I have this email from Jane who writes, the Bay Area is quite a big area and encompasses a lot of places that are very different from each other. I'm not sure that we really are aligned enough at the moment. You know, and Jane brings up a good point. You've got urban areas, San Francisco, San Jose, Oakland, you know, and those, the needs of those communities might be quite different than what is needed in Livermore or Fairfax or Palo Alto. So how do you, like, get everybody rowing in the same boat in the same direction?
Jane's right. She's absolutely right. We are 101 cities, nine counties, about 7 million people. And as regions go, we're pretty challenging. If you think about other regions, they tend to have a central city and then development fanning out from it, sort of like spokes on a wheel. The Bay Area has not one, not two, but three major cities. And then dozens upon dozens of smaller cities, including really small communities, bedroom communities. And so somehow that all has to hang together. But if that wasn't hard enough, we've got this pond out in the middle. And it's this massive chasm that doesn't actually unite us. It divides us. It makes us dependent on things like bridges and major infrastructure projects, tunnels, and all of the rest. So this is really hard. There's nothing easy about it, which is why it's so important that we think big and that we're visionary. And then finally, to answer Jane's question, yes, we all have differences, but we all have compelling reasons to come together and address the issues that Sujata's identified in a common framework. Mm. If we're talking and we're all talking together and that table is big enough, we can collaborate, we can come to consensus, we can take action.
Yeah. Well, this is State of the Bay on Local Public Radio, 91.7 KALW Bay Area, and I'm Grace Wan. We're discussing the ways in which the Bay Area can work together to address its challenges, how we as a region can sort of combat federal dysfunction. We're joined by the leaders of two local think tanks, Russell Hancock of Joint Venture Silicon Valley and Sujata Srivastava of ETSPR. Tell us about you, listeners, about how you're feeling about cooperation in the Bay Area and what are some regional issues that we can come together and solve. How do you think that we can be less siloed and work more cooperatively? You can join the conversation by calling 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-8255 or email us at stateofthebay@kalw.org. I think one of the hallmarks of the Bay Area that we all could be proud of and be thankful for previous generations is the creation of BART. Mm-hmm. And I know you, Russ, spent a lot of time trying to make sure that BART extended from the city down to San Francisco. Mm-hmm. But today, BART is looking like it's kind of on the skids. I mean, we love BART so much that it's in our theme song. Mm-hmm. So tell me about how, Russ, that was a moment of people really working together to be future thinkers. And, you know, in this moment, we have this great transportation system, and we all seem to be willing to let it fail.
BART was a major victory. It was envisioned first in the 1950s. It came to fruition in the 1970s. It was a vision of heavy rail surrounding the bay at the time, a very futuristic vision. It had to be sold. People had to go out and sell this vision to people who were voting and voting their pocketbook, and they made the case. And so it really was a major victory for the Bay Area. Three counties entered into the system. But at the same time we say that, we also have to point out that it was also a major setback for the region at the very same time. And that's because each county was left to make its own decision. And in a fateful moment in history, San Mateo County decided not to opt in to this system. They had their reasons. Now, decades later, those reasons don't seem to make any sense at all. But they were compelling to people at the time. And so the result was a rail system that is disjunct. In other words, unconnected to the rest of the bay, and it makes us dependent today on rail systems that are orthogonal. You couldn't even integrate them if you wanted to because they're different gauges. This is an example of the chaos and the confusion and the Darwinism, you could say, that characterizes the Bay Area. It's not the best way to do things. Hence, this notion that we should create structures and frameworks for truly regional planning and decision making.
Mm-hmm. I mean, Sujata, what do you think? I mean, here we are. We have these cities. We've got BART. We've got AC Transit. We've got Muni here in San Francisco. I mean, public transportation should be something that we can we should be able to work together. I mean, BART is amazing. It's such a fantastic resource. And yet it is kind of dysfunctional.
Yeah, I mean, you know, we've long been advocating for creating a much stronger, robust network of transportation that's safe, that's convenient, that's integrated, and actually goes where people need to go. But a lot has changed because of the pandemic and the way that it hit our region with, you know, much more hybrid work here than other places. In addition to cost pressures, the big transit operators, the ones you named, and also Caltrain are under a lot of financial strain, and they're going to have to cut service drastically if we don't do anything. So, you know, this is a moment where we really do need to come together as a region and support public transit. There will be likely a ballot measure. We're working hard to get a ballot measure on the November 2026 ballot that would authorize the five Bay Area counties that we've been talking about. So San Francisco, Alameda, Contra Costa, San Mateo, and Santa Clara to fund transit and make sure that BART continues to run. I mean, if we don't do this, BART would have to cut 80% of its service. That means going from 4,200 trains a week to just 500 trains a week, or eliminating two of its five lines entirely. So this is really a dire situation, and we do want to be thinking about how do we integrate transit, how do we make sure that we're really being efficient and getting people around well, but we're not going to be able to meet that challenge if we don't keep these systems going.
Mm. And Russ, is that, you know, Sujata's talking about this ballot measure that's going on, hopefully going on to the ballot. I mean, is that something, you had talked about this regional gathering of great minds and it included business. Mm-hmm. Is that something, is private sector help for a tax like this something that could kind of put us over the edge and get that passed?
A couple thoughts. One thing that's striking about the Bay Area is that our residents, our voters, have voted for taxes to improve transportation. We've done that consistently. But they've always been piecemeal. It's been a measure that lasted for a period of time and did a specific a number of things. And the things that it did was worked out through political processes, and it ended up sort of looking like a Christmas tree, not necessarily like coherent regional planning. That's been our approach historically. In other areas of our lives, like education, we don't fund it that way. We understand education to be something that needs to be permanently funded. And so there isn't some tax measure that expires after 10 years. We understand that we need to continue educating our kids and paying teachers into perpetuity. And I think it's time for the Bay Area to think of transportation in that way. And that's what this commission or task force that I'm describing could put squarely onto the table. A transportation, approach to transportation finance that never ends. Because our need of transportation and mobility also will never end. Now, where does the market come in? We can be using the market mechanism and things like congestion-based pricing and all of those things that the private sector understands so well, and that can be a part of the solution. And then finally, you mentioned the private sector. Yes, they need to be at the table. They have wherewithal, they have expertise, they have business acumen, they can also be funding partners. And we haven't explored that in the Bay Area in a way that is robust and anywhere close to meeting its potential. We would do that through public-private partnerships.
Mm. I mean, there's so much to say about the private transportation systems created by tech companies to bring people to their offices and why they don't rely more on public transportation.
Yes, you could say it amounts to a condemnation of the public of the public services.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I wanted to talk about a few more regional problems that can be addressed. And one of those is homelessness. And these are huge problems. I mean, we could do 6 hours of shows on each one of these things. But Sujata, I mean, homelessness has been tackled individually by jurisdictions, by cities. You know, you hear about bus tickets being given to the unhoused to get out of San Francisco in previous administrations, and maybe this one too. How do you make homelessness a regional challenge such that there is a regional solution?
We have been talking a lot about housing as, you know, as a regional issue, but we don't really have the right structure set up to really tackle this entirely as a region. We have fortunately formed something that may be able to do that, and that's the Bay Area Housing Finance Authority, with this idea that there's no single jurisdiction that can solve the affordability crisis on its own. And so being able to bring those 101 jurisdictions together is one approach. And what BAFA is able to do is it's the first regional housing finance agency in the state. It has the ability to raise money, allocate that money, and manage funding for affordable housing and for tenant protections. So this is kind of the entire continuum of homelessness strategies around preventing homelessness in the first place and producing housing of all types, for anything from interim housing to permanent affordable housing across the Bay Area. The challenge is now we're going back to like, well, how do we actually get these things funded? We still would need to put a ballot measure. You know, this goes into Prop 13 and all of the restrictions that we have on generating resources, but we would still need to pass a ballot measure that adequately funds BAFA to be able to take on these activities. And so, you know, some of the restrictions that we have on regional governance are coming from the 1970s, you know, and some of the measures that were put into place in the state constitution that really tie our hands in terms of raising the resources that we need to be able to coordinate appropriately. But we have the beginnings of something that could turn into a really powerful tool. And I think it's an interesting model for a lot of our other challenges of like, how do we actually create these entities, you know, very much like Russ's vision, create these entities that can really be cross-jurisdictional and tackle these issues.
Mm. Hey, Russ, what do you think about that?
Violent agreement with Sujata. And I just want to say I'm a fan, a big fan of Sujata and of Spur. We need to pay far more attention to Spur than we have already. So, it was a very significant day for the region when MTC, the Metropolitan Transportation Commission, and the Association of Bay Area Governments came together in ways that they never had done before to create this authority. And now we have to give it the tools that it needs to be really successful. There's good news. We happen to have the state's best legislator on this topic. His name's Scott Weiner. And we need to be behind him, other colleagues of his in the Senate and in the Assembly, so that we can do this in the Bay Area. Let me just stress that the homelessness problem is also a housing problem. Mm-hmm. We see them as distinct. They're not. We address homelessness by creating more housing and housing that's affordable. The way we do that is by building it.
Yeah, plain and simple, but not so mm-hmm. easy to do.
Yep.
I mean, I want to talk about the regional solutions, but I can't help but point out the fact that the federal government is doing a lot of damage, I mean, to our state, pulling out resources, I mean, assessing UCLA or the UC system with $1 billion bill, for example. And research is obviously a huge engine to the regional economy. Sujata, I mean, when you think about the ways in which the federal government is cutting its spending and kind of seems to have California and San Francisco in its crosshairs, I mean, how much damage can regional cooperation forestall?
I mean, I don't think there's any substitute for the, you know, the resources that are being cut. So there's no real replacement for those funding cuts and the damage that it does, especially to the most vulnerable folks in our region. And even before these funding cuts, we still needed to collaborate better to be able to get to the outcomes that we're seeking. And so I think, you know, as one thing that I really took away from Russ's piece is, you know, this is a call to action for us to really do what we can as communities to address the challenges that we have control over. But I don't think there's any doubt that the funding cuts that are coming down the line and some of the other regulations that have been announced are going to have a really deep impact and will set us back on some of our goals, particularly as they relate to climate change and income inequality.
Mm-hmm. I mean, Russ, when you, as Sujata said, your piece was this call to action. Mm-hmm. a lot of people feel helpless in this moment. I mean, they see what's happening at a federal level and they think, oh my gosh, that's too much. It's like a fire hose of policies that I don't know what to do with. Is thinking about this at a regional level, give us some, you know, our listeners out there, some advice on like what can they do to ensure that regional leadership addresses some of the problems that we spoke about?
You know, it has been a crisis for me personally, and that's why I was motivated to write the piece, because I was going through this existential angst, federal government doing all of these things that don't compute, make no sense whatsoever, hurtful, destructive, even. But I decided to back up and look at a bigger picture that, in actuality, it's been we haven't had a fully functioning federal government in a very long time. Going back at least to the 90s, when the partisan divide became more stark than it had ever been in any of the history preceding, and then the the calcification that set in, and the partisan gridlock and the dysfunction, and over that long period of decades, Congress didn't pass a single bill that took dead aim at climate change. Mm-hmm.
Or immigration.
Immigration is another perfectly good example. What we don't have is a high functioning national government, and now it's just exacerbated by the culture wars and all of those other things. But I got to the point where I realized it won't do us any good to obsess over that. That is what it is, and we'll revisit that every 4 years and see if something can be done. Meanwhile, there are all of these things that are right here in front of us, and they are within our control. There are things that we can do. Most of the things we've been talking about today, we can do without the federal government. We can do it with the state as our partner, but we can also do it ourselves. It requires imagination. It requires vision. And it requires a willingness to come together in a setting where we sit down and dream, think big, but do it in a way that's cautious, careful, systematic, thoughtful. But we can do this. And if we do, it will be empowering.
Well, that is certainly a call to action. And Sujata, I wanted to ask you, as we're running out of time, I mean, what makes you hopeful? I mean, we've heard Russ saying, like, we could do this. We could get this done. And what makes you feel that we can't do that?
Well, people like Russ and other folks who are champions, I think, in the Bay. And I think the other thing, we started off talking about BART and the success of BART. And, that really took a lot of different stakeholders to make that happen. And similarly with BAFA, that would have never happened without a lot of people on the ground advocating for this, housing advocates, people who were experiencing homelessness. All of those folks are the ones that actually have been pushing for change. And I see that activism still very well, very much alive when we're talking about transit funding. And we see all kinds of folks showing up asking for funding to make sure that our trains and buses are running. That's what gives me hope, is just the tremendous amount of energy from people from all walks of life that really deeply care about our region.
Do you agree, Russ?
I do. I absolutely do. I think we have an opportunity, and we should look to our peers. And when I say peers, I mean around the world. I think our peers are Hong Kong and Singapore. That's who we should be looking to. These are the great city states. They've figured this out. And those are not federal entities. Those are local entities. So there's a model here. And there's also talent here, unbelievable talent. So I think the only thing stopping us is our imaginations.
Well, speaking of talent, I spoke to two of them tonight. We are so lucky to be joined by Russell Hancock of Joint Venture Silicon Valley and Sujata Srivastava of Spur, telling us what they think that we can do on a regional level to bring hope to the Bay Area. I want to thank you both for being here.
Pleasure.
Thanks, Sujata.
Thank you so much.
Yeah. Coming up after the break, a new San Francisco walking tour of the haunts of America's first Black millionaire. Stay.
Never miss a beat with the KALW app. Stream your favorite music programs on your schedule, anytime, anywhere. Whether you're at home or on the go, the music you love is just a tap away. Download the KLW app now and stay connected to the sounds of the Bay Area.
Although little known today, the name of William Alexander Leidesdorf is enshrined on streets of San Francisco as ship's captain, civic leader, hotelier, entrepreneur, and diplomat. Leidesdorf was the first black millionaire in the U.S. and an integral part of the foundation and growth of early San Francisco. And here to tell us about him is San Francisco City Guy's very own Eric Friedman. Eric, welcome to State of the Bay.
Thanks, Fred. It's great to be with you.
Well, it's great to have you. Now, there are people in San Francisco who love city guides, history geeks like me, and we've had some of your colleagues on the show in the past. And for those who are not familiar with what SF City Guides is, can you give us a quick, maybe 30-second elevator pitch?
Sure. It's a privilege to be a city guide, Fred. We're an independent, nonprofit partner program of the public library in town, and we have more than 73 tours. They're led by enthusiastic volunteers like yours truly, who love San Francisco. Mm-hmm. We welcome visitors from all around the world and lots of locals too. So if you have house guests, hand them a juice box, send them our way. We're a great adult daycare option. We've got a schedule online at sfcityguides.org.
I also should add, if you didn't mention it, it is free.
It is free.
You don't want to pay money. That's perfect.
That's right.
So you yourself, you've been creating tours for visitors and residents for about 3 years. Can you tell us just how did you come up with the idea of doing a city tour on William Leidesdorf?
Yeah, it was the magic of those street signs in San Francisco. One of my stops on the Boom and Bust Tour, another great gem for city guides, is at the corner of Leidesdorf and California. And people started to ask, you know, what is that? What's that name? And so I dug in and I got hooked. I think it's just a fascinating story. He's woefully undertold figure, and the story is almost unbelievable.
So what is Leidesdorf's origin story? I mean, how did he make his mark on San Francisco?
Fred William Alexander Leidesdorf was born in 1810 on the Danish island of St. Croix in Danish West Indies. His father was Danish, of Jewish origin, but converted to Protestantism in order to pursue economic opportunity. And his mother was a free Afro-Caribbean woman, Henry Sparks. William went to sea as a boy, and by the 1830s, he is in New Orleans, where he's ready for the next step in his career. He wants to be a ship's captain. In order to do that, though, he has to become an American citizen. In 1841, he takes command of another ship, and he sails to California, and he's going to join the whole trading network that's connected to the hide and tallow trade in California. It links Yerba Buena, what's now San Francisco, to Hawaii and Russian Alaska. So at the time, Yerba Buena is beginning to emerge as a key place for the hide and tallow trade, but it's also a little village of shacks and sand dunes. Grizzly bears are wandering out of those sand dunes to fight with coyotes and wolves or fish on Montgomery Street. Leidesdorf, though, was a visionary, and he saw potential there. In a few years, he opens the first commercial warehouse in town. He opens the first hotel. He owned a shipyard, a lumber yard, a ship's chandlery. He had the finest house in town with the only flower garden. He hosted visiting dignitaries. His hotel was where the Declaration of Independence was read aloud for the first time in San Francisco. He became vice consul representing the U.S. and had a key role in the American takeover of Yerba Buena in 1846. After it became an American territory, he was elected to the town council and founded the first public school in California. He even organized the first horse race near Mission Dolores. Along the way, he acquired a 35,000-acre ranch right next to John Sutter's property, land that was soon at the center of the gold rush. And Fred, for your listeners who don't speak acre fluently, 35,000 acres is San Francisco plus five more Golden Gate parks.
Thank you for explaining that, because I was like, okay, acres, I have no idea. I understand that his story is one of reinvention. Why don't you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, Fred, this guy was a chameleon. He pursued opportunity wherever he spotted it. The St. Croix sugar plantations were a dead end for him as a man of mixed race, so he left. He passed as white. He learned 6 or 7 different languages. He adapted to challenges and opportunities wherever he could find them. In order to take command of a ship in New Orleans, he had to become an American, so he did. To get that ranch in California, he had to become a Mexican and convert to Catholicism, so he did. He launched business after business, some thriving, some failing, always taking risks. Even after his death, his story was reinvented. John Folsom reshaped it to claim his estate, which is why, unfortunately, the tragedy of this story is that Leidesdorff Ranch is now called Folsom, California. After his death, people have continued to change his story and celebrate his achievements, but at the same time, they suppress some of the troubling parts. For example, some of his wealth came from the exploitation of indigenous people. And at his hotel, he hosted California's first black minstrel show. So we're living in a time when that's happening to us again. The president is pressuring the Smithsonian and the National Park Service to erase or downplay facts about slavery and Japanese incarceration. I think Leidesdorff's story is a reminder of why we need to resist that. It's a remarkable story, but we need to confront the whole truth, not just the parts that flatter us.
I agree. Was Leidesdorff actually the first black diplomat in the U.S.?
Absolutely, yes. He was in this critical place in Yerba Buena. Thomas Larkin, who was the U.S. consul in Monterey, which was the head of Alta California under Mexican control, recognized that he needed a person in Yerba Buena as its economic importance grew. Leidesdorff was the right guy. All of those different languages that he spoke made him well-suited to interface with the different players who were jockeying for position in Yerba Buena. Leidesdorff was the perfect guy, multilingual, well-connected with Mexican authorities, a seasoned mariner, and a successful businessman.
But he was also black or partially black. So knowing that this is probably a presidential appointment and that Polk, who was president at the time, was from Tennessee and also a slave owner, how did a black man become a diplomat?
It's pretty astonishing. So Larkin writes a letter and he recommends Leidesdorff. Couple of distortions about Leidesdorff in that letter. So pretty clearly, neither of them knew. But Leidesdorff was very successful in the role. And what's an even funnier little twist to the story is that by then, Leidesdorff is a Mexican citizen, but he's appointed to represent the United States in Mexico.
Now, this is a walking tour. Ironically, we're talking about it on a radio show. We don't have video, so you can't see it. Tell us, what do you actually show your tour groups? And how does this play into the theory that legends have intruded on historical fact when it comes to Leidesdorff?
Yeah, it's a fun problem because that part of town, Montgomery, California, has burned down repeatedly, including 7 times in the 1850s. So you got to bring your imagination along with that juice box. We have a surprising amount of public art, but that's where the legends enter into the picture. There's a statue on Leidesdorff and Pine that looks great, but it misrepresents his appearance. And it's the kind of unexamined glow up that I think is misleading. It showcases only the good, and that's a problem. This is a guy who derived considerable wealth from exploiting indigenous people, and he even hosted the first black minstrel show in California. So his circumstances, the system that he succeeded with, was every bit as cruel as the one that he fled, and I think we need to look at that with clear eyes. There's another plaque near Sacramento in Leidesdorff that includes an oft-told legend called the New Orleans Love Affair, and it's pure melodrama. It's an absurd story, and yet people love to tell it. But what's more interesting is the story of that story. Why do people tell it? And so we wrestle with that on the tour. And then probably the greatest piece on the tour is this mural that went up in 2023 on the landing at Leidesdorff, and it's enormous. Unfortunately, there's a huge goof that has a portrait that's as tall as you or I, and that is not actually a portrait of him. Yeah. So we, again, are intruding not with a legend, but with visual misinformation. We look at that, and we're coming with all these expectations. We have to see, how did this man look? How did he do it? How did he pull off being a multiracial person in this incredibly difficult setting? And I see that, and I go, oh, wait a minute, that's not him. And so now the lens of the mirror is back on us. Why are we so taken with making race the center of his story? And it opens up the space for us to imagine, you know, who we are and to what it's like for us to take the helm of our own ships and chart our own destiny.
That's a great description about how we should be looking at history. I hate to say it, but I think we're out of time. I would love to keep hearing you talk about, I find this gentleman fascinating. If you'd like to take Eric's tour or any one of the many walking tours with San Francisco City Guides that they offer, check out sfcityguides.org and sign up. Eric, thank you so much for being on Today of the Bay. It's been a pleasure.
Oh, it's been my pleasure, Fred. Thank you for having me.
Well, that's State of the Bay this week. We're taking Labor Day off, so we hope you'll join us in 2 Mondays at 6 o'clock. And remember to subscribe to the State of the Bay podcast. For more information about this and other State of the Bay shows, you can visit our page on KALW.org. And if you have any emails, questions, comments, or story ideas, send us an email, stateofthebay@KALW.org. Tonight's show was produced by Wendy Holcomb and Jillian M. Blad. It was engineered by Devin Strolovich, and Tariq Ansari was our fantastic board operator. Coming up next is Not Born Yesterday, the show about the joys and challenges of aging. It's going to be exploring the issues and opportunities of getting older with experts in the field. I'm Grace Wan. Good night. Thanks for listening.